I'm Hugo Desler from Farming Secrets. We had the pleasure of meeting Rob Fenton at Dalesford in Victoria. And Rob Fenton, we've got him online. And Rob is the, you'll have to tell me where you are, but the chief of the National Environmental Centre at in the Riverina Institute for TAFE. So, Rob, would you like to come online and briefly introduce yourself, or introduce yourself as much as you like, and give us a bit of the history of yourself or the farm?
Yeah, sure, Hugo. Good evening, everyone. I'm head teacher here at the National Environment Centre, which is just a specialist TAFE campus just north of Albury. One of our major roles is to provide organic farming training around the country, which we do, and we also run courses in organic farming here on site. And we have a 500-acre certified organic farm, which we use in our teaching and use to model ecological farming and organic farming.
And so, Rob, when did the concept, or when did the farm actually start? And what year did the farm start? And what were some of the steps that you looked at? And you did mention that, when you started, there was a certain degree of uncertainty. So
yeah,
you might like to give a bit of rundown in that area.
Sure. We started up in the mid to late 90s. We started the design process of the farm system. We were looking at a number of uncertainties in the future in terms of designing food production systems. We knew we were uncertain about the climate. We were also uncertain about where energy was going to go, peak oil and that sort of thing. And we were also uncertain about how fertilisers were going to go, and particularly organic fertilisers. So we knew that there was a whole lot of stuff we didn't know. And so we decided that we'd develop some design tools to help us design food production systems in uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that was where my talk went at Dalesford that Hugo's talking about. We're talking about the different design tools.
Right. Rob, can you give us, or give the people listening to us, a bit of a mental picture of what your farm looks like? You did mention, like, for instance, you had trees in a certain part of the farm. And
For those that are familiar with the Albury area, we're just north of Albury. It's rolling clay country, quite infertile, where our pH in calcium chloride in a lot of our paddocks is about 4.2, and it's low in everything except aluminium. Basically, the pattern of soils in this type of country is that you've got a soil type in the hilltops, you've got another soil type on the slopes, and then you've got another soil type in the drainage lines. And so where the farm is basically designed with that in mind, so the hilltops are treed. We use them for native habitat. We use a bit of them for firewood production, honey production. We produce a bit of honey. And also to modify the climate in the paddocks on the slopes. All the slope sides of the hill parts is the major productive production part of the farm where we run our sheep. We grow olives, we grow garlic, and we're just setting up to do free-range chicken based on wattle seeds and free-range pork. The drainage lines are all very dispersible clays and highly mobile soils and easily erodible and not very fertile. They're all tree systems as well, either as native habitat, as woodlots, haystack paddocks and things like that.
Mm. You did mention one part of quite a few things in your talk at Dalesford really stuck out, and one is that you're very energy conscious. Can you sort of
One, because we were uncertain about how available cheap energy will be in the future, and two, because industrial energy is polluting and adding to the greenhouse problem, and et cetera, et cetera, and it's expensive anyway. One of our major design tools is a thing we call one-star, three-star, five-star energy. One-star energy is anything that uses fossil fuel. So when we turn the tractor on and burn diesel, or use electricity in the workshop, anything like that we call one-star energy. It's expensive, and it's going to get more expensive and harder to get, and it's also polluting. Three-star energy is cultural energy. That's the energy that I'd use doing my work, or my students would do. So if I went down the paddock to, say, Chip, St. John's Wort or something, I'd be using cultural energy. Now, that's not as polluting, but it's all work, and is often not as effective. Five-star energy is ecosystem energy, where we design the farm system to do the work for us. Some really simple examples of that are where you would, instead of using one-star energy to spray the weeds or three-star energy to chip the weeds, we use grazing management or different types of grazing animals to control the weeds that way. Go on, Hugo. When we're designing the system, when we're looking at changing things, we apply that test all the time. So, for example, at the moment, we're in the process of writing up our organic management plan for our free-range egg production. We get audited for organic production shortly. Everything we do there, we test with the one-star, three-star, five-star energy. So the one-star way of feeding the chickens, as another example, would be to purchase in feed from somewhere else. The five-star way of doing the feed is to grow the wattle seeds that fall to the ground, and the chooks harvest up when they need them. So there's no work involved. The chooks just grab the wattle seeds when they want them. So there's no one-star energy used at all. So that's what we do all the way through the system.
And right. Briefly, because I want you to explain this in more detail towards the end, what sort of students do you have on the property? What is the education system's targeting, and what sort of students?
Sure, yeah. There's a number of different groups. We run a diploma in organic farming by distance for farmers that are setting up organic systems over Australia. And we've got students in every region in Australia basically studying organic farming. We also run an internship here where people come and work with us on the farm and do their study that way and end up getting a diploma in organic farming. And we also run short courses and part-time courses here too. But the main one that the students are actually involved on the farm are our interns, and they spend between 12 months to 18 months with us.
And is it somewhat exclusive? What's the prerequisite the people who want to get educated by your system?
There's no prerequisites into the organic farming. We basically work on first come, first serve, and we try and not say no to anyone, but the interest in organic farming is just, it's just, you know, going through the roof at the moment, so the demand in our courses is getting higher and higher.
I suppose that there's no room on the farm, so to speak, when the short courses, there's always that the distance course that people could join.
There is, and there's another one we're working on at the moment, Hugo, where we're looking at setting up a national organic farming traineeship, pretty much along the lines of the traineeship system that works at the moment, where someone that gets employed on the farm gets training through us, they get some subsidies, and the farmers get some government subsidies as well to employ them. So we're looking at that as well.
All right. In your energy system, you mentioned oats as a... can you just briefly explain how you grow the oats and actually why you select oats instead of some other crop?
Yeah, righto. One of our one-star systems we try and use is long-term annual crops, where we might direct drill oats in 1 year, which, and we've just done that about a month ago here. And then we use it. We use them for a little bit of winter feed through about now. Then we let them flower and set seed and let the seed drop to the ground. We use some of the seed on the ground to feed for our lambs. I should have explained earlier that we sell all our organic lamb at farmers' markets, and so we have to produce lambs all year round. We produce and ready for market, you know, 52 weeks of the year. So we during the summer we feed them on the oats on the ground until the oats have gone back to about one oat per square inch on the ground. And then we just let that regenerate the following year. But depending on what happens, we might get, you know, 4, 5, or 6 years out of that one sowing of an oat crop. If you get a false break, that throws a spanner in the works a bit. But it seems to work pretty well for us. The reason why we use oats is because we really focus on really low inputs, and we don't. We direct drill straight in. We crash graze with the sheep, and then we direct drill straight in, or even broadcast out of a super spreader and walk the sheep over the top of them straight in. And oats seem to compete against the Patterson's curse and the other weeds that we tend to have here.
And do you get like a couple of grazes during the winter months, and do you have to strip graze?
No, we get one graze, but the reason why we get one graze is that being organic, we don't drench at all. Our worm management process is to have a really long rotation between our grazing paddocks. We've got about 70 paddocks, and the way we look at it, you've got you've got about 4 days after the manure comes out of the sheep before the worm eggs start to become effective and forming cysts on the blades of grass. So we can get 4 days grazing out of a paddock, and then we try not to get them back there for many months. So that by extending that rotation out, the number of worm eggs that are left on the pasture when they come back is less, and so we don't get any worm problems. And so we can't get two grazes out of our oats because the rotation would be too short. So we get one decent graze and then that's it.
You mentioned weeds and also one
yep.
particular weed that annoys the daylights out of farmers in your area and most New South Wales is Patterson's curse. Now,
yep.
How do you cope with Patterson's curse to the point that, some sort of a
yep.
problem when the neighbours look at your place and see Patterson's curse on your property, if they do, don't get quite upset. They could get upset. So how do you sort of cope with Patterson's
curse? Yeah, if anyone knows Thaguna, which is where we are, it's Patterson's curse paradise. Mr Patterson, who introduced Patterson's curse, lived just up the road from us here. Patterson's curse can very, very easily become dominant in our pastures, but we know we aren't concerned too much about it because it's really telling us that we went into the autumn with not enough ground cover on the ground. We get Patterson's curse with bare ground in autumn. So the first thing we do is we make sure we don't have bare ground, which is classic organic farming anyway. The three really hot weeks, the bushfire weeks we had last summer, basically ruined our ground cover, and it probably did for a lot of other people as well, ruined our ground cover. And it basically blew away in those 3 weeks. We had, 3 weeks of well above 40 degrees day after day, and all that ground cover just disappeared. We've got our Patterson's curse is fairly dominant in quite a few of our paddocks now because of that. The way we deal with it, first off, we don't worry about it too much. It doesn't seem to cause any significant health problems in our stock. We make sure we've got a really good balanced mineral diet for them anyway. And also what we do, if we've got a paddock that's really bad this time of year, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but if you go for a walk out in the frost early in the morning and you stand on a Patterson's curse plant, it goes black within 15, 20 minutes. It doesn't actually kill it, it doesn't actually kill it, but it takes it, it dies right back almost to the central growing point. So we actually, when we get a decent frost, we actually harrow any of our paddocks with a ute, just dragging a set of really simple pasture arrows behind the ute. And what it does is it moves the leaves of the Patterson's curse, and the liquid in the cells of the Patterson's curse is frozen, and the crystals actually crack the cell in the Patterson's curse. So the Patterson's curse actually dies back to next to nothing in about 15 or 20 minutes. And so although we haven't got completely rid of the Patterson's curse, it gives chance for all the other plants around to actually grow up around it, so it's not as dominant. We can't spray because we're organic, and in the spring we use our sheep to eat the Patterson's curse flowers and stuff like that. We've always got some, but we don't tend to worry about it too much.
The other interesting thing that you said, and I think it's very good to repeat some of these things that you said at this meeting, was that you found that the Patterson's curse in actual fact broke the hard pans.
That's right. We've got fairly dispersible clays, and we've got some compacted soil, not as much as we used to. The really vigorous taproot of Patterson's curse does a couple of things. First off, it can tend to drive its way through the more compacted soil in the soil profile, whereas the fibrous roots of grass and clover don't. And so that's one advantage. And secondly, it puts an awful lot of organic matter in our soil as well. Just the amount of, you know, Patterson's curse driving through that hard area where other roots can't get to puts organic matter there, which helps our soil anyway. And so, you know, the carbon levels in our soil is going up all the time.
Now, what was the carbon level when you started on the place, and what does it matter? Straight away, which is there a way that you can, knowing what you know in the past, can you fast track what you've achieved? The question's there.
Oh, fantastic question. First off, as I explained before, we use very similar to cell grazing. So we're building up large root mass in the soil, and then chewing it back. So that helps keeps the soil alive, and I'm pretty sure it introduces more carbon into the soil. There's actually work starting to come out at the moment that says it doesn't. I'm not so sure about that, because other than not having bare ground, some of our soils here have gone from, you know, 0.7% carbon up to 4 or 5% carbon over the decade we've been working. I personally, without any proof, but just from my experience, I put a lot of that down to the soil, to the roots in the soil that are dying back as we graze them down, or they die at the end of the season. In terms of making it quicker, I know that when we do keyline pattern ploughing, which is a bit like deep ripping on speed, we immediately bring the soil a bit to life. The challenge for us is that pattern ploughing using a tractor is one-star energy and breaks one of our rules, so we try not to do it that often. So we could probably speed it up a bit more by doing a bit more soil aeration, but that breaks one of our rules, so we haven't.
From what I hear you say, it's managing the surface or managing your herbage, whatever, so that you get more organic matter in the soil, and that seems to be the key.
Yeah, the way we look at it, an organic farming or an ecological farming situation, we're not actually farming olives or sheep. We're farming, we call them greeblies, the critters that are living in the soil, all the soil microorganisms. And so our focus in managing the farm is first managing the greeblies and then second managing our sheep or our olives. And I think that's probably the key to it, Hugo, is if we look at what the soil microorganisms need, it's very similar to what we need. They need shelter, they need food, they need water, and they need friends. And so we manage the greeblies to do all that sort of stuff. And I think that drives, that allows the organic matter that's around, either on the surface or in the, inside the surface, to be become part of the ecosystem.
So basically, if a farmer concentrates on just what you said, does puts every practice in place to encourage that, he's going to build up his organic matter.
Yeah,
water holding capacity.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And I think that would hold, doesn't matter what your soil type is or where you are. If you are focusing on looking after the greeblies, if everyone understands what I mean by that, then everything else tends to follow from that. And as you say, we basically, as a rule of thumb here, reckon that for each percent carbon we get in the soil, we can hold another inch of moisture. And so so our spring will run a little bit longer, or we've got a little bit more moisture to use at the end of spring than maybe our neighbours do, because they'd still be at the less than 1% carbon.
Yeah, it's really saying something. Another very interesting thing that you talked about was your leafy dams. Now, you might have described those. That's also what what intrigued me is, can any farmer use those leaky
I don't know, Hugo. Look, what I'd like to be careful about with the things like these leaky dams, that I know they work in our situation, in our landscape, and in our soil type. So, what's the more important thing really is what the leaky dams are actually achieving, and then people try and work out how they achieve that themselves. Most people are probably